Welcome to Wabanaki Windows. I'm your host, Donna Loring. Wabanaki Windows is being brought to you by WERU in East Orland, Maine, in partnership with WMPG Portland, Maine. Today, we will have a discussion with David DeJong, author and Middle East correspondent, from a very different global historic and economic perspective. Our guests today are Professor Harold Prince, a Dutch citizen of the Netherlands, distinguished professor of anthropology and an emeritus at the University of Kansas. Our special guest is David DeJong. David is a journalist and author. His first book, Nazi Billionaires, was published in the US and the UK by HarperCollins and is being translated in more than 20 languages. He spent 4 years reporting from Berlin while researching and writing this book. David previously covered European banking and finance from Amsterdam and hidden wealth from New York for Bloomberg News. His work has also appeared in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and Bloomberg Businessweek. A native of the Netherlands, he currently lives in Tel Aviv and works as a Middle East correspondent for the Dutch Financial Daily. I want to thank David for taking time from his busy schedule to talk with us today from Tel Aviv. We are extremely fortunate. Our discussion today will be about David's book, Nazi Billionaires and the Hidden History of Five Wealthy Families. David's book reveals the story of these families and how they obtained their wealth. This story is not unlike the wealthy families of the early Europeans in their quest for land and wealth. David, thank you for being here, and please tell us about your book.
So in my book, I focus on what are today Germany's five wealthiest business dynasties. So one is the Quant dynasty, which are the controlling shareholders of BMW. One is the Flick dynasty, which were the former controlling shareholders of Daimler Benz. One is the von Finck dynasty, which is the co-founding family of Allianz and Munich Re, two of the world's largest insurers and reinsurers today, and it also owned a private bank called Merck Fink. And the fourth family is the Porsche Pierre dynasty, which co-founded Porsche and Volkswagen, but also controls car brands like Bentley, Lamborghini, Seat, Skoda, Audi. And fifthly, it's the Utker dynasty, which is not as known in the US, but focuses on, owns the largest beer brewer in Germany and a range of luxury hotels in France and the US and England and Germany as well. And so I was a reporter at Bloomberg News in New York, and I focused, you know, what struck me during my reporting was that these families celebrate their fathers and grandfathers for their business successes, but leave out their war crimes and their Nazi affiliations. And I found it to be such a distortion of history, such a brazen whitewashing, that I wanted to shine a light on it. And that's why I moved from New York to Berlin to research and write the book for 4 years. Yeah, and Nazi Billionaires is the end product of that. You know, I focused on, you know, for me, the starting point is a contemporary one, which is to focus on what are today's Germany's wealthiest dynasties and, you know, that profited the most of the Third Reich, whether that was through, you know, mass weapons production, the expropriation of Jewish-owned businesses or businesses in German-occupied territories, or the mass exploitation of forced and slave labor, and how they got away with their crimes. So how did they get involved with the Third Reich? How did they profit from the Nazi regime, and how did they get away with it after the war, and how are they dealing with that history now are kind of the four questions that drive the book.
Yeah, I thought it was really interesting, though, the fact that when you decided to do this and you went to Germany for like 4 years, it's my understanding that you really didn't know the language all that well, the German language.
No, that was for Bloomberg when I was start reporting on it. from New York, because I was Dutch, so they thought, okay, this is this Dutch guy, I'm sure he speaks fluent German. But once I moved to Berlin in 20, so that was in 2011, once I'm, and that's where, you know, the basis of my reporting started, as when I was on this investigative team at Bloomberg News in New York. But when I moved from New York to Berlin in 2017 to research and write the book, you know, yeah, my German was pretty good at that point. Because, you know, you have to conduct archival research and primary source research, and, you know, be able to read a lot in German. So, yeah.
Harold, do you want to ask anything?
Yeah, I was kind of interesting. Hello, David. You're
Hello,
in Tel Aviv right now?
I am in Tel Aviv, yeah.
So, yeah, so as Donna was just asking you about how you came to write your book on the Nazi billionaires. And as a fellow Dutchman, I'm quite familiar with that same puzzlement about how Nazis came to power. For me, that question is not just historic, it's also contemporary, because we are now at the cusp of a change where many democracies are under siege. Democracies are messy, as we all know. And it's understandable in a rapidly changing world that a lot of people who are feeling threatened, that they're looking for a strong leader. And you know, of course, much more than most people about what precipitated the rise of Hitler. But it came, of course, in the wake not only of the Weimar Republic, which was the result of the defeat of Germany in World War I, but it was a tremendous resentment and a feeling of, paraphrase a contemporary movement in the United States, make Germany great again.
Right.
And that's exactly what he did. And the tools that he used as a demagogue was to create two enemies. One was the enemy within, which was an alien population to the German homeland and the German people, which were the Jews, and a enemy outside, which was really the Slavs, the historic enemies of the Russian Empire that had gone communist, and the Iron Curtain that had been raised in 1917 with the Bolshevik Revolution that threatened many people in Germany, including the large capitalist interests, such as the ones that you are investigating. So the common thread that I see and why Donna has invited you for the show is, to what degree are there parallels between what you saw in Europe, and leaving aside what we see today, but what has historically happened in North America and in South America and in many other parts of the world where European colonization took place, and the dispossession of indigenous peoples, or the raiding of human capital in the form of slave labor and transporting them to the Western Hemisphere. So that's really the interest of the conversation that we are going to have, I hope, is that comparative historical perspective that allows us to see both similarities as well as differences, because the differences are obvious, but the similarities are often not so obvious. And that's a tricky terrain, because it's easy to get accused of exaggerations, right? And the last thing anyone wants is to be accused of an exaggeration, because you lose your credibility if that happens. So just in your case, in your focus on these dynasties in Germany, and really the whitewashing, what I'm interested in is the whitewashing of history and the amnesia, if you will, the forgetfulness, which is not accidental, that's deliberate, right? It's engineered. And it doesn't happen in a vacuum either. So that leads me really to think about the denazification and the role of the Americans who occupied part of Germany, and in particular John McCloy, who fascinated
me.
Yeah,
absolutely. Absolutely, yeah. I mean, John McCloy is also, in that sense, a key figure in the book. You know, of course, the architect of also the Japanese internment camps in the United States. He was war secretary in the Roosevelt. He was war undersecretary in the Roosevelt administration. And he is really the architect, together with Henry Stinson, of the of what, you know, what post-war West Germany will look like. Of course, initially there's a Morgenthau plan, which calls for the summary execution of all German industrialists and the wholesale destruction of German industry. And, you know, it's really Stinson and McCloy who prevent that from happening and put in these punitive measures, which include, of course, the Nuremberg trial, which foresaw three trials against industrial, or initially a separate tribunal, but it ends up, for politically expedient reasons, you know, such as the Cold War, such as the start of the Cold War, end up in three separate legal trials against Friedrich Krupp and his manager, Alfred Krupp and his managers, IG Farben, the executive board of IG Farben, and one of my main characters in the book, Friedrich Fleck and his managers. But most importantly, once you know, you have the failure of the Nazi, it's a twofold. You know, initially you have the implementation of these so-called denazification proceedings in occupied West Germany, which, you know, in early 1947, with the rise of the Cold War, you see this accelerated handover of hundreds of thousands of suspected Nazi war criminals and Nazi sympathizers back to West German authorities by the American and British occupation authorities in Western Germany. And, you know, there's no incentive on the side of West German authorities to judge their fellow compatriots on crimes that they've committed themselves or sympathies that they had held themselves. So these, you know, one of the myths I'm trying to dispel of the book is that denazification never really took place in West Germany. There was this vacuum of 5 years between 1945 and 1950 from the Third Reich to the establishment of the Federal Republic, where the Allied authorities, at the very least, could have a kind of oversight of these denazification trials. But instead, you have millions of Germans going scot-free for their crimes because there's no incentive to research. I mean, it was all to investigate them properly, right? I mean, mind you, this is also total chaos in occupied Germany. There's various zones. You have the French zone, you have the British zone, you have the American zone, and of course you have the Soviet zone. But nonetheless, you know, the Allied occupation authorities have zero oversight because they don't exert any oversight because, you know, they now, at that point in time, what's important is to rebuild West Germany as a vital democracy and as a strong economic force, as a bulwark against communism and the Soviet Union, and as a buffer to protect the rest of Europe. So Nazis and Nazi Germany soon become ancient history, which again is also, which you also see in the Nuremberg trials, where the separate tribunal for industrialists is reduced to three trials. But then there's a second phase, which so you have money and power continuing, you know, directly from the Third Reich to basically, you know, uninhibited by this 5 years of vacuum of the occupation, of the Allied occupation, to West Germany. But then, of course, once McCloy becomes High Commissioner for Occupied Germany in 1949, you know, he starts, or 1950, he starts commuting all the sentences and death sentences of convicted Nazi war criminals from the Nuremberg trials, right? So we're not talking just about industrialists such as Alfred Krupp and Friedrich Fleck, but you're also talking about high-ranking SS officers who have slaughtered hundreds of thousands, whose death sentences are commuted to life sentences, then their life sentences are commuted to 5 year sentences, and by the mid-1950s, they're all back on the street and released. And the reason for this is, again, is a political expeditious one. You know, the U.S. enters the Korean War, you know, Truman and then Eisenhower next the War Defense Act. where, you know, all American factories start churning out armaments for the Korean War. And West Germany revitalized, economically revitalized, is the key industrialist, key nation to kind of fill in the gap, the consumer goods gap that the US needs, as there is a huge bottleneck with regards to production in America because of the War Defense Act. And they want West Germany's support under Chancellor Konrad Adenauer in their fight against communism. So Adenauer says, well, you're keeping our men in prison on our soil, you know, and we want to join NATO and we want to have our own army again. So, you know, the trade-off for West Germany's support, both their production prowess as well as their political support for in the America's fight against communism, is that you have, you know, men, you know, Nazi war criminals with hundreds of thousands of you know, convicted for the murders of hundreds of thousands, mainly Jews, being left, being, you know, being their sentences being commuted. So you see in both those instances, so the first half, so the second half of the 1940s, with the denazification trials, a, you know, dominant political, a dominant political expedient thinking with regards to we need to rebuild West Germany. Once West Germany is rebuilt, you see this, the first half of the 1950s again, is political expedient thinking with regards to those high-ranking Nazi, quick-sentence Nazi war criminals who are then released out of in the street because America wants West German support.
But if I may quickly, McCloy indeed becomes a high commissioner. He's the first one. He's succeeding five American military governors, right? Succeeding 5 years. But his job before he became the high commissioner was that he was the second president of the World Bank, a new institution. And that role of the World Bank, coupled with the Marshall Help, the big project that named was named after the Secretary of State George Marshall, that was about the rebuilding, indeed, not only of Germany as a powerful buffer, as you just put it, against the Soviet bloc. That, as we all know, East Germany was under Moscow control, so the threat to the industrial heartland of Europe, really, which was the Ruhr, that the Allied bombers had done their best to destroy as much as they could between 1943 and 1945 by massive bombing raids out of England. Now it's all being restored with American capital, but that was not without self-interest. And back to McCloy, I find fascinating because he is, in a way, a poster child of global capitalism in the sense that he, before the war, was counsel, legal counsel to, amongst others, the big oil companies, and in particular, Standard Oil, which was the big Rockefeller founded oil companies later dispersed. And so, what I would like to hear from you is to what degree is the pre-war sympathy in many circles in the United States, which had as the largest ethnic group were German Americans, that was the largest ethnic group in the United States. There was a great reluctance on the part of Americans to get again involved in another world war out in Europe. And to what degree people like Henry Ford and other big time capitalists, the father of John Kennedy as the ambassador in England, they
Joe
were not
Kennedy.
there, right? So that whole reconfiguration of how we think about the rise of fascism, if you took an inventory in 1930s, the mid-1930s in the United States or in England, you would have seen a very different picture than we like to believe afterwards,
For sure.
all the atrocities came to light and
For
so forth.
sure.
In other words, the story is so much more complicated than the
Yeah.
cartoon version that we have about what really
Sure.
happened.
Yeah, sure. America came in, you know, conquered, reconquered Europe and denazified Germany, which is, yeah, which is patently false. No, I mean, yeah, if you look at, you know, an increasingly isolationist America, even under FDR, you know, with what's his father Coughlin and all these, you know, the speeches that pervaded. You have, you know, Henry Ford publishing, which is a bit earlier, you know, this anti-Semitic rag all these spreading, it was pivotal in spreading all these anti-Semitic, you know, conspiracy theories that still are very dominant today. But he already starts doing that in the late 19th or even late 1920s, early 1930s, or late 1920s even. I just read a book about it, The Money Kings by Daniel Shulman. It's a really good book, which details something. There's a chapter on Henry Ford too. And yeah, I'm not sure what Joe Kennedy, because of course, you know, JFK very forcefully argues for against appeasement. He's in college at that point, and he's living in London. He's at the London School of Economics, and he writes his thesis on, you know, against appeasement and against Chamberlain's appeasement policy. But sure, I mean, these are, you know, so I'm not sure what Joe Kennedy's stance was at that exact time. But you know, we know that Henry Ford was a virulent anti-Semite who idealized Hitler and vice versa. You know, men like John McCloy, you know, McCloy being an establishment Republican, a lawyer, prominent lawyer, prominent banker, truly an establishment man who came from humble beginnings, but you know, became a man, establishment figure through and through. You know, had the capitalist interests of the United States and to that extent also, you know, West Germany at heart, you know, and one of the things that you see once he starts commuting the sentences of Nazi war criminals is the furious reaction of Telford Taylor, who was the main prosecutor in the subsequent Nuremberg trials. You know, wrote in The Nation in 1915, the American magazine The Nation in 1951, fulminating against McCloy's political expedient decisions and, you know, seeing all his hard work over the past 5 years, not being for naught, but, you know, being diminished for sure. And he wrote letters to Eleanor Roosevelt, trying to get her on his side and etc., so that she would speak out and all these things, and yeah, it was a gut punch for him.
But you mentioned anti-Semites, and that's true with Henry Ford. But another element that is often forgotten is a major ideological inspiration for Hitler in the late 1920s when he was in Munich in prison. He read a book, a translation of an American book authored by Madison Grant. I'm not sure if you know that, but Madison Grant.
No, I don't. I don't. I don't know this. I've never heard this.
Yeah, it's a very important book. Madison Grant was a trustee of the American Museum of Natural History. The Grand Zebra is named after him, by the way. But he wrote a book in, I think it was 1915, during World War I, before the Americans became involved. But the title of that book is The Passing of the Great Race. And the Passing of the Great Race was translated into German in, I think, 1921 or 1922. And Hitler refers to that book as his Bible. So the important thing here is that there's a thread. That's really what I'm interested in, to make the link between Germany, the book that you have focused on with the big capitalist dynasties that came to power well before Hitler, then colluded with the Nazi regime, and they were resurrected very quickly after the war, and the restoration of the all the possessions that Alfred Krupp, for example, had, and was then proclaimed as the wealthiest man in Europe and became the cover of Time magazine, I think, in 1957. So it's a remarkable,
something like that. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a remarkable narrative.
Tournament. Yes. Yes, indeed.
Yeah, so it's a remarkable narrative, but what is the difficult challenge given what happened in North America and many other parts of the world is to what degree the dispossession and the genocide of indigenous peoples here, right, is also subject to a collective amnesia. In if you look at the American history books, I was just looking at an article in Maine History in a recent magazine, and it's a complete false picture of what is written over and over by ignoring, you know, how wealth was constituted in land that was taken over from indigenous peoples by warfare, but often financed by banks, for example, including Dutch banks in Amsterdam. Amsterdam, of course, was a financial center, as you very well know, throughout the 17th century, 18th century. And these banks fascinate me because here you see these people who are investing in bonds or in shares to get a return on their money, but they don't really know what that money does once it is loaned to a borrower who may finance an army, such as the American Revolutionary Army, to fight during the American Revolution, largely financed by Dutch banks, as you know. The Louisiana Purchase.
I didn't know that, to be honest. I didn't. I wasn't aware of that. I mean,
it's a fascinating history that I became aware of as the expert witness for the Penobscot Indian Nation, Donna's people, during the latest court case, a federal court case, all about the sovereignty of the river, the Penobscot River, which is in the heart of the homeland of the Penobscot Nation. And I, as a Dutchman, suddenly began to see names like Henry Hope.
Oh, wow.
Who I knew, he has still the big old white house there on the Herengracht in Amsterdam. I just saw it last November. But I look at that building with very different eyes now that I know how Hope & Co. operated, just like the Baring brothers, founded by Francis Baring and his brother, whose son, Sir Francis Baring in London, himself, by the way, of a Groninger family. The Barings come from Groningen originally, my home area where I was baptized.
Moved
to England to Somerset, and then got into banking and became the major force between the British East India Company. And they cooperated, Francis Baring and Henry Hope in Amsterdam and Francis Baring in London. And they bought huge tracts of land here in Maine that was still legally in possession of the Penobscot and Passamaquoddy Indian tribes. 1 million acres east of the Penobscot River, and then 1 million acres here in the Upper Kennebec, which just like a few decades earlier had been the territory of a genocidal campaign during the so-called French and Indian War, which itself was in the interest of Boston merchants, including James Bowdoin II, who was the governor of Massachusetts, and after whom Bowdoin College was named. So what I find interesting is how money, right, capital, creates that distance between the people who furnish the capital, either in large numbers in small sums or in large sums by small numbers, but it creates a distance between what that capital actually does on the ground, whether it's a factory using slave labor or prison labor or white slaves in Europe during World War II, or the financing of armies to dispossess indigenous peoples of their homeland, or raiding or financing ships to transport black captives from Guinea or Ghana, you know, to Curaçao, for example, right? For the plantations. So that's all pretty much territory that you know as someone who has read Eric Wolf, who was one of my professors. But that's one of the fascinating things I've heard about the rise of global capitalism, colonialism, and the coming to terms today, right, by a lot of people who were disenfranchised and dispossessed, to start saying, hey, those history books are very one-sided. Who is writing that history for whom?
Right, exactly. I mean, that was very much Eric Wolf's thesis too. Yeah.
So the reason I'm thinking, and I believe you expressed it, David, that you did the research and wrote the book, was to hold these wealthy corporations or responsible for their actions. In what happened during World War II, and you wanted that to come to light. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's about the families, right? So the families that control these corporate, that control these companies, that I wanted to, as I said earlier, for what they engage in through global charitable foundations, through media prizes, through academic, through naming of academic chairs, through corporate headquarters named after their fathers and grandfathers who committed, war crimes on a mass scale. And this cover-up of this history is what I wanted to shine a light on.
Yeah, and you also mentioned that some of these companies, when they're faced with what their legacy has been, they create or finance studies, and these studies end up being thousands of pages in academic German language or whatever that, and nobody really sees them.
Well, you can see them, right? But I mean, this is a way to kind of pacify the subject, is to, a scandal breaks out in Germany regarding beloved patriarch X or beloved company Z. And then they say, oh, we'll commission, independent historians to investigate our history, and you don't hear from it for 4 years. And then this study of 1200 page in academic German is published, which contains all the details, but of course it will never reach a wide audience within Germany. It's only discussed in academic circles, let alone reach, it's never translated. So heirs the heirs of victims of forced slave labor, of the million of the tens of millions who were exploited as forced slave laborers in German factories and mines, they don't have any access to those studies. They don't have any access to what happened to their father, to their parents or grandparents who were exploited or who were used as forced and slave laborers. And so they hide kind of these histories in plain sight, but it's also, there's also kind of leaning on this kind of slightly desensitized, the German public, has to deal with revelations regarding the Third Reich still today on a daily basis. And especially as the far right is rising now in Germany again, so, and they're slightly inundated against such revelations. And I think these families and these companies kind of bank on, they lean in one way on Germany's culpability, but they also bank slightly on its desensitized attitude with regard to the Third Reich because of this inundation of information over decades, right? So they can pretend on a global level, on a consumer-facing level, as if nothing has happened, and just praise their fathers and grandfathers for their business successes, how they saved BMW from bankruptcy, et cetera, all these things, and not, and leave out any of the dark pages of the history.
So your book has been translated into German?
It has been, yeah.
And how long has it been out in Germany?
Almost 2 years in the beginning of May, it was published 2 weeks after the English language edition, the original edition.
Has the book had any impact?
It has, yeah. There's been three major developments. The Quant dynasty that controls BMW, they have a foundation named after their father, Herbert Quant, who was saved BMW from bankruptcy in the 1960s, but also, built a sub-concentration camp in German-occupied Poland, exploited thousands of forced and slave laborers, including female concentration camp captives, in a battery factory he owned in Berlin, acquired companies stolen from Jews. And BMW today has a foundation named after him, the Herbert Quant, the BMW Foundation Herbert Quant, which is, has hundreds of millions under assets, and has a tagline: "Inspire responsible leadership in the name of a Nazi war criminal." And after the publication of my book, there was such a backlash against, trying to whitewash the name, or having be given, fellows who had received money in the name of a Nazi war criminal, and them trying to cover that up, that they were forced to hire an outside lawyer to advise on the name change or what were to be done regarding to the process, about how the foundation can go about its name change or being transparent about its history, which is a, you know, suffocatingly slow process as a German, you know, company would have it. So that's one major development. The other one is that the Porsche Piëch dynasty, you know, they had a Jewish co-founder, a man named Adolf Rosenberger, which was pushed out of its company, who was pushed out of Porsche in 1935 for being a Jew, and was subsequently erased from Porsche company history. And because of the publication of my book, there was such pressure exerted. You know, they had been negotiating a kind of a moral restitution for some years now in the background. But, you know, there was such pressure exerted on the Porsche Piëch dynasty to kind of come clean to its history, or to clean house, as it were, that they settled that it's kind of moral settlement with the heirs of Adolf Rosenberger in Claremont, California, to rewrite Adolf Rosenberger back into Porsche history. So that those results we will see most likely in 2025, 2026. Yeah, and then thirdly, you know, the Tel Aviv Museum of Art had been given a massive donation from Ingrid Flick, who's Austria's wealthiest woman, and she's never paid into any kind of restitution fund, even though her father-in-law was convicted at Nuremberg for war crimes and crimes against humanity, and they put that donation under review. So these are some of the developments that the book has had since it was published almost 2 years ago.
Wow, that's really good. At least something positive came of all of that.
Yes.
And revealing that sort of power and what these wealthy people have done. Harold?
Yeah, I found it interesting. You just mentioned Fick was her last name.
Flick.
What is fascinating, of course, is that Austria never went through the de-Nazification.
Yes, indeed.
You know, one of the things that should not be forgotten is what really happened in 1945 during the planning, because by that time it was obvious that Germany was about to be defeated, and plans were being made, and a reconfiguration of the powers were already being brainstormed, not only in the United States, but also in London, of course. People like Churchill, who later gave that famous speech about the Iron Curtain, which of course was a concept that he did not invent, contrary to what a lot of people think. That concept was already in circulation and used by the Germans to warn against the firestorm of the communist revolution as it was ignited in 1917 in St. Petersburg, briefly called Leningrad. And so what has happened is that early on, the ideological, political, economic divide that divides Europe from north to south, with a lot of pro-communist, strong communist parties like in France and in Italy in particular, it was a great fear that all of continental Europe would be taken over by the Soviet Union already in 1945. And one reason for the escalation of the nuclear armament and the threat of using nuclear weapons by the United States, briefly, the only power in the world that had nuclear weapons, was that the troops on the ground, the tanks and the infantry that the Soviet Union could muster to overrun all of Western Europe was very real. We've forgotten that now. So we now see a reverse almost, that Russia is threatening with nuclear weapons. But in the early phase of the Cold War, it was NATO, in particular the United States, that could threaten the Soviet Union with the use of nuclear weapons, which they did threaten with. So we see a very complicated narrative within which these people like Alfred Krupp gets rehabilitated, right, by McCloy,
right,
in the context, as you mentioned earlier, of the Cold War, and that escalates with the Korean War and the Chinese Revolution, 1949, right? 1949, the Chinese Revolution succeeds. Communist China is emerging as a powerhouse very quickly in Asia, and then you have the Korean War as a Chinese-backed invasion of South Vietnam, threatening the American hegemony. It was just established in the former French colonies, and begins to threaten the Dutch East Indies, right, which had a complicated history also in terms of the independence of Indonesia. And so that whole rehabilitation of these Nazis and these Nazi sympathizing capitalists only, in my view, can be made sense of if you remove them from the particularities of Germany and put them into the context of the global war, as you did right in the beginning of this interview.
Okay, so there's a question I want to ask you, David, and it's, do you see any similarities between what happened in Germany and what's going on in the United States now?
With regards to, can you be a bit more specific?
Yeah, with regards to Trump administration prior to take over the government like January 6th, I would guess that there are also big money behind that.
I think the comparison is more toward with Russia, with Nazi Germany and Russia, right? Where you have, you know, the Russian oligarchs laying the basis of their foundation of their wealth during Yeltsin's reign from 1991 to 1999. Putin comes in and then they consolidate, you know, they make this devil's pact. And it was similar with Nazi Germany, with Germany, where most of the people, most of the men I write about made enormous wealth, created enormous wealth during the politically volatile and economically volatile Weimar Republic. But they consolidated, almost lost everything, you know, during the Great Depression, just like the Russians did in the late 1990s as well, during enormous economic volatility, times of enormous economic volatility, or the Russian oligarchs. And then the Germans consolidate, or the German industries consolidate their power and sign this devil's pact with Hitler. That's the more apt comparison, I would say, or historically speaking, to what is going on today, as opposed to the US, where you have, you know, Biden in power. You know, January 6th was certainly a coup attempt, attempted treason. You know, several committees, you know, congressional committees have investigated it, but democracy still exists in the US for now, yeah, right? But one can't say the same for what occurred in Putin's Russia, right, and in Nazi Germany.
But I wonder if that same paradigm, that thought process of how the corporations actually helped Hitler with his vision. You know, Trump has been compared to Hitler.
We get the
Ford, the Ford company and IBM and.
But that's not now, right?
Well, that thought pattern, the paradigms that.
Listen, I mean, you have massive dark money packs in the U.S., right? I mean,
okay.
The Supreme Court rulings, the Citizens United 2010 Supreme Court ruling, Citizens United, right, which saw for the starting of super PACs and dark money PACs, right? But that's abused by both sides, you know, Democrats and Republicans alike. So I find it a stretch to start making historical comparisons to the Trump administration, which is not even in power, which there was a thankfully, there was a successful transfer of power from the Trump administration to the Biden administration. I would say rather than focusing on what happened, the events of 2020 and 2021, where certainly the Trump administration or Trump and cronies tried to, you know, overturn the election results and tried to, on January 6, 2021, basically stage a coup. Why don't we focus on what will happen in 2024, this year? You know, because the events of 2020, 2021 did happen, but they didn't lead to a, you know, in the end, the democratic institutions of the United States for now have, you know, survived. So I think it's not an apt comparison at all to what happened, and also you know, baselessly speculating on who or what was involved, or you know, that's not, you know, kind of big money interest. We can focus on super PACs, dark money PACs, you know, but those are, again, you know, it's the Democrats who use it to fund as much as Republicans do.
Well, to that point, what I think is an important piece to keep in mind, and you, of course, know that as a Bloomberg reporter very well, is that capitalism and capitalists are not a monolithic force, right? It's not like...
What?
And I've always wondered to what degree the rise of Darwinism, you know, as a theory in the 19th century coincides with the rise of industrial capitalism, in the sense that both thrive on competition, right? There's a element which goes against the idea of a monolith, as if the capitalist powers are one block. It is not, right? There's a huge confrontation between capitalist forces, whether they are captains of industry with factories or banks, right? And so they compete against each other. And so, to Donna's point, and you responded to a way, in my view, correctly, that both the Democrats and the Republicans both have big money behind them. At this moment, the Democrats are outracing the Republicans in terms of the capital accumulated for the next election cycle. And you see capitalist corporations lining up or captains of industry donating to both sides, right? So ultimately, the system of capitalism itself, just like in Germany, in spite of the rise of National Socialism, right, the Nazi variation of capitalism survived. And then when the Nazi power is over, it gets resurrected, right? So the nature of capitalism is very peculiar, because, and often misunderstood, because people don't realize it's an ecosystem of its own, right?
Right. That, and I mean, I always say, you know, capitalism is it's amoral, right? Like, you don't, it flows where it goes, right?
I mean, that's exactly true. Yeah.
Even with the Third Reich, with the industrialists at the beginning, after Hitler seizures of power in 1933, you know, it doesn't start off with criminal behavior. Hitler initiates the largest rearmament, you know, that the world had seen to date at the time, which is technically okay. It's technically forbidden under the Treaty of Versailles. It's not, you know, it's not yet criminal behavior, but it quickly devolves into criminal behavior in order to expand their bottom lines, right? In order to expand their businesses and empires, in order to profit, because that's mainly what these men were interested in. They were opportunists, you know, they were, for the most part, they weren't ideologues. So you know, yeah, in the US, you see, you know, I mean, it come back to the point that it doesn't start off as a criminal endeavor, but it quickly devolves into as morals and any kind of moral scruples go out of the window, and you know, people's lives and livelihood get robbed and seized, and in the end, of course, it ends into the largest forced labor program that the world has seen to date, with estimated between 12 and 20 million people who are, you know, who are deported to German factories and mines to be exploited there, you know, either as slaves or as forced laborers, who get paid far less than their German counterparts did.
And the extraction of
under the most horrific of circumstances.
Totally true, but also the extraction, of course, of oil and other precious natural resources in the occupied territories, right? So
yes, right, yes. Yes, particularly in the East.
Yeah, so that's the fascinating thing indeed about, and you use the term that is absolutely apt, of amoral, and that's the nature of capital, in the sense that it creates that distance in multiple links between the investor, right, and maybe a small saver who buys a life insurance policy, right, who that the life insurance policy may go to a multi-fund, right, through a investment company that gets invested in other kind of issues. And all we are looking at is the interest on our money, right? Does my investment, my IRA or my Roth, make 6% or 8% or 6%.
Right.
And the wealth manager working on your behalf, if you have one, right, will look for opportunities completely bereft, usually, of any kind of marker, whether that money is actually contrary, is working contrary to your own ideological preferences, right? So you may be against fossil fuel, but you may have an investment in Texaco, for example, right? Or whatever kind of oil company or black coal, doesn't matter what it is. And so that's the danger of capitalism, in a sense that the left arm doesn't know what the right arm is doing and vice versa. And so that's exactly one of the lessons I think that I draw from your book and for your audience, is that the amorality of a guy like Alfred Krupp can make him the cover boy, literally, of Time magazine in 1957.
Sure. Yeah, sure. Yeah, totally. Yeah.
It's astounding, right?
Okay. So does anyone have any last thoughts about our conversation? Or I look at the history of the United States and the Native people and the land that was stolen from the tribes all across the country, and thinking that, you know, land is in fact needed to grow a nation, needed for wealth and power. And I'm just looking at the rest of the world, like in Germany, what happened there, and you know they needed land there too, and the nation was built with you know wealthy people who had money, and that's the same thing. I mean, they kind of like reached over the ocean into North America back in the 1400s or whatever, but for land to start building a nation. I see a similarity there in how things historically progressed. And a lot of people have, and I told Harold early this morning that a lot of people have told me that they see the Palestinians as they see the Indians of North America. There's a comparison that they make there. So I'm just wondering, do you see any, as a last statement or whatever, is there any kind of similarity that you see, David?
I work as a Middle East correspondent. I've been living in Israel and Palestine for 2.5 years. So my job is not to make any kind of historical comparisons on that front. And I think the domestic debates that are going on in the US, Netherlands, and Germany with regards to the October 7th attack and subsequently the war between Israel and Hamas in the Gaza Strip, you know, are completely disconnected to the reality on the ground here. And I think it's very important to keep in mind.
Right. Very good. Harold?
Yeah. A quick comment about land. And Donna was mentioning the land. Of course, back to Germany, David will be most familiar with the term the Lebensraum that the Germans were looking in their conquest of Eastern Slavic population occupied, inhabited territories all the way pretty much close to the Volga. I mean, that's where all the natural resources were located and where Hitler and his party members were looking for massive depopulations of territories to get occupied by relatively overpopulated Netherlands, for example. Half the population of the Netherlands was supposed to be moved to what is now Poland, amongst others. And so here are these historic fights about land, and not just land, because there are nations that get very powerful in the financial ecosystem, and they don't have much territory. Luxembourg is a good example, and Liechtenstein even more so, and Monaco, right? So here you have...
Absolutely.
Capitalist enclaves that don't have much land, but they have a lot of other resources at their disposal. And back to Donna's point about the colonization of North America, it was not just about land, of course, it was also in the case of Mexico and Peru in particular, but Bolivia, of precious metals, silver and gold in particular, but also copper. So it is a massive quest for precious natural resources as well as land. So land is one of the factors The other one is natural resources. The other one is simply finance capital. You know, you don't need to have even a lot of gold or silver on your territory. It's simply the vaults in your bank or underneath the bank. In the case of the exchange in Amsterdam, had a huge amount of bullion in silver right under the foundation. And the Swiss banks, of course, also are known to have huge stacks of gold and silver in bars underneath in big vaults in the Alps. And so that makes the world so complicated to understand, because much of that is hidden by bank secrets, for example, by transactions in boardrooms that no one will ever know about. And even an astute reporter like you, David, has probably sometimes a hard time trying to figure out what exactly is going on regarding what I'm supposed to be writing about.
Absolutely. I mean, yeah, I mean, it didn't take me 4 years. I left Bloomberg and to focus on researching, writing this book. And it was 4 years of full focus to undertake such an, Herculean endeavor. And I'm sure that whatever my next book may be, it will be, it might be double that time. Who knows? You know, it's very hard getting that information and getting the access, but, persistence, I guess, pays off, both for the good and the bad. I think those are the good final words on my part.
Okay. All right, David, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us.
It was a pleasure, Donna. Thank you for having me.
Yep, thank you. Wabanaki Windows is being brought to you by WERU in East Orland, Maine, in partnership with WMPG Portland, Maine.